Now the Three Martini Lunch with Greg Corumbus and Jim Garrity.
And welcome, everyone, to the Monday edition of the Three Martini Lunch. Jim Garrity of National Review is back with us today. I'm Greg Corumbus of Radio America. Good, bad, and crazy martinis for conservatives today, as usual. And we go to Jim's latest edition of the Morning Jolt for the good martini today. Obviously, last week was a very rough week for former Secretary of State, former First Lady, former Senator Hillary Clinton, who's likely to be the Democratic nominee for president, or at least was until a few days ago. Jim, this whole email scandal has not only put the Clintons on the defensive and put them in a position where they respond to scandal much worse than they normally do, but as you point out in the jolt today, there aren't a lot of Democrats leaping to their defense. There were things that were just, if not more, indefensible in the 90s that Democrats would throw themselves on the sword for the Clintons for.
It's kind of striking. There are a lot of dogs that are not barking in this set of circumstances. And maybe we've just kind of gotten used to seeing Democrats march in lockstep to defend Obama on things like the IRS scandal or the VA scandal or healthcare.gov. You know, they're constantly willing to say, oh, it's somebody else's fault. It's not his fault. With this one, no one's willing to claim, there are very few people who are willing to say, who don't work directly for the Clintons, who are willing to say, there's no scandal here, this is not a big deal, she probably was just following the advice of her tech person, she's just this sweet grandmother who, you know, used the wrong email address, we've all been there. There were two or three that jumped out at me, and I wrote a bit about this in the Morning Jolt, that one, Dianne Feinstein, coming out and saying, no, she's got to come out and explain what's going on here. Mark Halperin coming out and saying he doesn't think she's going to be the president anymore and that this has become reflective of something and that something deeper and all that stuff. There's a quote from an unidentified senior administration official in the New York Times saying, if they screwed up in the emails, if we find out they skipped over her emails, then that will be a problem for them. It'll be a scandal, but it's not one that we'll own. Nice little signal. This is not our problem. This is Hillary's problem. We are not jumping on that grenade for her. I think it's interesting to see all these folks really willing to let her twist in the wind, arguably throw her under the bus. Obama was quick to say this weekend, look, all of his emails on his official presidential BlackBerry get officially archived, and he's not doing anything like this. A couple of people have said, this is them all setting up Elizabeth Warren, which I suppose is a three-level chess strategy there that they could be going on. I think it also just could be a matter of the Clintons have always had this enormous sense of their self-interest and their entitlement. And I think they may have just kind of presumed just how far Democrats were willing to go. And kind of the other last aspect that kind of jumps out at me about this, Greg, is that you notice nobody's saying, oh, there's nothing scandalous in those emails, right? And the funny thing is that nobody's even making that argument. You might expect the Chuck Schumers of the world, you might expect some of the true loyalists come out and say, oh, come on, it's, you know, making me think, not that they know that there's something incriminating or serious in those emails, but they're not certain that there's not something in those emails, i.e., hey, we're really hoping to get some help with our policy here. Could a billion to the Clinton Foundation help us out? You know, I don't know if things are ever as direct as that, but this ties around the same time as the foreign donations to the Clinton Foundation, and lots of people have said there's just an obvious conflict of interest for Hillary Clinton to be setting U.S. diplomatic policy and foreign policy, while at the same time, foreign governments, foreign corporations, and groups like that can give lots of money to a foundation that has her name on it. It's an unprecedented set of circumstances and seems like a form of legalized bribery. It may be interesting. We've reached a point that even Democrats aren't willing to try to go out and try to push that.
Might be mixed in with some Clinton fatigue there. I found it hilarious, of course, that the president knew nothing of this until media reports, because we've never heard that before.
Yeah, you know, that's standard operating procedure. Actually, the fun question I'd like to ask, Mr. President, at any point during the 4 years of your first term, do you ever email Hillary Clinton?
Right.
Yeah, it's possible he didn't. It's possible if he needs to talk to her, he picks up the phone. It's possible he has his aides tell Hillary such and such. It's all conceivable, or they're meeting face-to-face often enough that they didn't need to email. But I'd love to see that question put there, because then obviously we can FOIA his emails. And then the next thing is, if they did, Mr. President, didn't that email seem weird to you? Like, weren't you afraid you were getting, like, Clinton spam or something like that? So it's kind of fascinating that so many Democrats are not rushing to the barricades to help defend Hillary here.
Yeah, very interesting. All right, on to the bad martini, although you could twist this one in a good way to, once again, reflect on the Clinton record. This is from the Washington Post. Thought the Soviet Union was anti-American? Try today's Russia. After a year in which furious rhetoric has been pumped across Russian airwaves, anger toward the United States is at its worst since opinion polls began tracking it. From ordinary street vendors all the way up to the Kremlin, a wave of anti-U.S. bile has swept the country, surpassing any time since the Stalin era. The story goes on to talk about how one of the most credible conspiracy theories about the murder of Putin critic Boris Nemtsov is that it was a CIA plot to discredit Russia. And ever since they've been tracking Russian sentiments towards the United States since 1988, we're at the highest level now. More than 80% of Russians hold negative views of the United States. So given the back and forth over Ukraine and some other things over the past several years, it's not surprising that they're not thrilled with the United States. But, Jim, this is definitely not the direction that the Obama administration promised 6 years ago.
Yeah, we've talked on our podcast before about Putin and kind of the reflexive, let's say the conservative perspective on Putin, maybe not if always the Republican perspective on Putin. Probably one of the most regrettable things that George W. Bush ever said was his comment about looking into Putin's eyes. You look at this and you kind of are sitting here thinking, like, those of us who are not Kremlinologists, those of us whose knowledge of Russia mostly comes from news coverage, not a deep study of Russian history, have this very basic sense of, oh, well, they used to be a superpower, they're not anymore. And there are a bunch of people in Russia who are very upset about that and who'd like to be a superpower again. And what's more, they know we won. They know that our philosophy, our vision, our ideas beat theirs. And they're less wedded to the communism part of their past than the being powerful part of their past, being respected, being feared. And they want to get that back. And so they will act like bullies in order to get that back. They believe they should be world leaders. And that basically since the Boris Yeltsin years, they're kind of dismissed as this laughing stock, this decrepit, decaying former superpower that is aging and the infrastructure is falling apart and they're all drunk on vodka and they're all involved in sex scandals. And if they didn't have gas and oil, they'd be an absolute, you know, basket case. And, you know, Vladimir Putin comes along and says, I'm going to get you out of this. We could be great again. I'm going to make us great again. Just everybody's got to do what I say. If you disagree with me, I will shoot you in the street. And we're, first step, we took over Georgia or a chunk of Georgia. Now we're taking over chunks of Ukraine. And it turns out that this very simplistic view of the Russians that comes out of the hunt for Red October and Crimson Tide and all and The Saint and all of these movies in which Russians are the bad guys turns out to be pretty accurate. You know, Hollywood can actually give you a decent understanding of Russians, you know, being these emotionally needy, vindictive, nasty, insecure bad guys. And that ultimately is what is the character here. So the idea that a reset button is going to make things all so much better, that seems laughable to us back in 2009, and now we're seeing how ridiculous it is now. As long as we are number one, as long as we are the world leaders, the Russians are going to hate us, or a certain number of Russians are going to hate us. And the only thing that will make them not hate us is China being more powerful than us. They're always going to hate whoever's on top of them. And, you know, some of us are much more comfortable with that, you know, status of life than I think your typical progressive or liberal is. But I think that, you know, basically since 2009, we've been operating our foreign policy with Russia as we wish they were instead of as they actually are. And it's not surprising we find ourselves more hated than ever by them.
All right, on to the crazy martini now, which does have a positive development over the last day or so. But here's the story that broke last week. Students at the University of California, Irvine, have voted to make their school a more culturally inclusive place by banning the American flag. The Associated Students of the University of California at Irvine passed a resolution March 3rd that would remove the Stars and Stripes along with every other flag from the lobby of a complex housing the offices of the student government. A couple of quotes here. Designing a culturally inclusive space aims to remove barriers that create undue effort and separation by planning and designing spaces that enable everyone to participate equally and confidentially. Another quote, the American flag has been flown in instances of colonialism and imperialism. Flags not only serve as symbols of patriotism or weapons for nationalism, but also construct cultural mythologies and narratives that in turn charge nationalistic sentiments. And the guy leading the charge here, his last name was Guevara, which is probably fun and ironic. The executive cabinet of this crazy group reversed the ban on Saturday in emergency session, so you can have your American flag at UC Irvine. But Jim, the fact that it got that far is insane.
The one I'm glad there's a happy ending. And it's not like that's unbelievably, that's just kind of a natural extension of what we've seen going on campuses. Because, you know, you mentioned Mr. Guevara. You know, I don't know if he was wearing a Che shirt when he said that. But it would be rather, you know, fitting if he did. And the guy on your T-shirt killed people for being homosexual. The guy on your T-shirt killed people for disagreeing with him. And here you are whining about American imperialism and colonialism, et cetera, et cetera. Would you please, you know, recognize, like, look at history accurately? And I actually think Americans are pretty straightforward and clear-eyed about the flaws in their history. I think the problem with the political correctness and a lot of what you see this leftism on campus is that inability to see anything beyond that, beyond slavery and oppression and you know, women not getting the right to vote and things like that. You know, the founding fathers being white male oppressive slave owners, et cetera, et cetera. They can't, you know, the interesting thing is that they claim that mainstream America or middle America is insufficiently nuanced, but they can't see anything other than their ideology when they look at American history. So on the one hand, it's not surprising. I think that, you know, what's interesting is I think they would probably ban the American flag. Would they say the same thing about the United Nations flag? I mean, we look at that and like, hey, you know, we're not part of the United, you know, we like the United Nations. We have representation in the United Nations. We're not governed by the United Nations. They're not really United Nations. They're United Governments. You know, anything where Sudan gets to head the Human Rights Committee is not an organization that we want to have too much to deal with. And that's, you know, what we've kind of become to expect from you know, college campuses. Obliviousness to their own contradictions and rage whining, as I put it a couple of weeks ago.
Yeah, there was an MSN story on this, Jim, that says, as weird as this story is, it might not be the end of it. They said there's a Pew survey, doesn't say when it was taken, but just 32% of millennials say the U.S. is the greatest country in the world, compared to 48% of Gen Xers, 50% of baby boomers, and 64% of the silent generation. So millennials, get your act together.
Yeah, I mean, look, kids, what are you going to do? Get off my lawn.
Jim, good to have you back. Talk to you tomorrow.
See you tomorrow, Greg.
Jim Garrity of National Review. I'm Greg Corumbus of Radio America. Thanks for being with us today, and be sure to join us on Tuesday for the next 3 Martini Lunch.